So I'm going to jump back over here to Romans chapter 12 after that small hiatus there. Have you ever been like this? A woman was invited to a new member's coffee and tea gathering. As soon as she was invited, she immediately began to talk about her schedule and how tired she was, how overwhelmed and weary all of the things on her calendar made her. She kept going on and on and on with all these obligations and reasons, well, really excuses why she couldn't come. The person inviting her noted later how her obligations not only affected her calendar, but they affected her very life and living. You ever been that way? Had so many things on your calendar that, of course, some of it might have been, you know, those things where, you know, some of us guys might have been where we asked somebody out on a date and they said, well, I'm busy that night. We say, well, how about in 2 weeks? Well, I'm busy that night too. Without even consulting the calendar. But have you ever felt that way where your calendar was so overwhelmed? Or as I have said oftentimes over the years, on some days I meet myself in the doorway and don't have time to speak. Wonder, and it makes you wonder what obligations she had that affected her heart, though, too. That kept her from going to the tea, that kept her from fellowshipping with other Christians, that kept her from going to church and spending time there as well. We could probably spend the next 30 minutes just talking about, bringing up and talking about different things that keep people out of church and keep people away from religious obligation, not just in church, but even at home. So many schedules going here and there. And I must admit that as our boys got older and older, we spent less and less time eating where we started out eating when they were younger and growing up, and that's around the table. And even today, about the only place most families will eat around the same table at the same time, except for Thanksgiving and Christmas. That's right, when they go out to lunch or dinner, when they go to the restaurant. But then, they're not going to talk about religious issues most of the time, not going to talk about spiritual issues. They'll just kind of chat about ball games and schedules and other things like that. Except Mary recently mentioned in a post, we were actually in Chick-fil-A with Quinn not too long ago, and we were sitting there eating, and this is in Taylor's, and there was a family having a family meeting in the Chick-fil-A at the table about this far away. It was an older gentleman, his wife, and two of their grown sons and a grown daughter. And one of the grown sons was holding court, and you could hear him berating the father for not doing better about doing this and about doing that, and all this kind of stuff. And about 15 minutes into that conversation of being berated, the dad finally just got up and shuffled off and went out to the car and sat in the car. Mary posted, I wanted to get up and walk over and slap that man in the face. Not the man that left, but the son that was, and tell him this is not the place to be doing that and embarrassing your parent. Not really. But anyway, I digress away from about the only place we eat around a table anymore as families is if we go out to eat. Except at Jim's house. And then the whole family comes.
Yes, sir.
So, and that's not a bad thing. Nope. Papa, what's that up on the shelf? Those remote control cars. And Jim said, oh, those are old. They don't have batteries. And a little bit later, he walks back in, and Ozzy's pulled something up and taken them all off the top shelf and has them in the floor, trying to see if they'll work. Well, you know, we have all kinds of obligations, though. What are some of the obligations you have, some of the duties you have each day? Well, Bible study. What other obligations? Work. Cooking. Cleaning. Right, cooking, cleaning, mowing the grass. Yeah, going to work, paying the mortgage or rent. paying the car payment, medical bills. Seems like for some reason the older I get, the more of those come around and more frequently, right? Wink, wink, nod, nod. Appointments at work, appointments at the doctor's office. I got in pretty quickly last time, but Mary said the last time she had a doctor's appointment, after sitting in the waiting room 40 minutes past her appointment time, and then in the room another 25 minutes, on her way out, she said, "I think y'all need to just cancel this bill or let me send you one for my time." Which one? Oh, then they won't want to see.
We went in there and wrapped the towel around it, and we tried to call up there and couldn't get in. I said, "Let's go." So we took off up there. We went in there just a couple minutes before they closed. And I didn't even shut down. They said, "Come on."
Yep.
You what?
Uh-huh.
It worked that time.
Right. Right, well, that's true. That's true. Right. Well, you know, we know those things. We know those obligations, and we have them. They're required. I mean, we have to do something. When we have those appointments, when we get sick, we have to do something. And they can upset our day, especially if they're unexpected, or if they run longer, or something like that. So we have those kinds of obligations. And Paul often talked about obligations that he had. I'm bound to such and such. I'm eager to such and such. I am called to such and such. He knew that cultural demands and spiritual demands were both important. In Roman culture, the culture demanded adherence to the Roman law and duty no matter what, and it was everyone's required duty to perform their obligation or else. Well, in Romans chapter 12, picking up on that kind of an understanding in writing to the Romans, Paul then moves to talk about a new obligation. A new obligation for Christ followers, which is connected to what he previously wrote about coming to know God and about being saved. And then he said, therefore, if you are one of God's children, therefore, I appeal to you. And actually in the Greek text, therefore occurs at the beginning of the sentence, not in the middle. I appeal to you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship, or a lot of translations, the older translations say, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. So Paul moves here. He said, okay, you've been given the opportunity to be saved. You've chosen to follow God. You've received that redemption, that salvation. Great. Nope. That comes with a therefore. If you have done this, then therefore, here's the obligation. It's not just God gives you the blessing, says, okay, go have fun with it. Go sit down and enjoy it. But God gives you the blessing with a therefore, you must be responsible and do this. And of course, throughout the entire Bible, we find that God never gives blessing without expecting responsible action. And that's the case here. And he will talk about that and that particular lifestyle as worship. We mentioned this morning as worship, that which is worthwhile. And so worship is to be a lifestyle. Present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable, which is your reasonable service or your spiritual worship. Connecting the spiritual and the physical. It's not just enough to say you believe and sit around and think wonderful thoughts, but something to be done with it. It's a lifestyle which encourages peace with God, but it also gives you the peace of God, or it's supposed to. Bring about healthy relationships, not just with God, but healthy relationships with others around you. Eventually, he says, even your enemies. So Paul and Jesus are kind of on the same page there, where Jesus says, you've heard it said, love your friends, hate your enemies. I say to you, pray for those who persecute you. And humble service. Now, chapters 12 through 14 in the book of Romans, we'll find, are predominantly exhortations. Exhortations. Where Paul challenges us to live as devoted Christ followers. I exhort you, I plead with you, I beg you, I instruct you. All of those things are rolled up in that idea of exhortation. Jesus said the greatest commandment is to do what? Love God. First and foremost, then your neighbor accordingly. That's right. So, how do we show God that we love Him? How do we do that, though? Yeah, we show our love for God. That's right, and that's what we just said with the greatest commandment. We show our love for God. It's enough. You know, we love God. Well, that's great. Now prove it. We show it by loving our neighbor.
I don't know if I've said this before. I was reading an article one time on John Wooden, and he said that when you admire him in his office, it is because of a basketball player reading the Bible. Someone asked him, you know, about his religion one time, and he says, well, he says, I put my family first, God second, my basketball team third. He says, I know it's not supposed to be that way. It's supposed to put God first. But my mentality of that is, if you put your family first, you're putting God first.
If God is part of your family, yes.
Yeah.
So what are some things that we do to prove it? We love our neighbor by doing a variety of different kinds of things. And that is worship. And we often think of worship, once again, most of the time as something we do in this setting. But worship for Paul and worship for Jesus is how we live our lives. Because we're offering ourselves to God. And so it involves corporate worship and a corresponding lifestyle. Paul was really big on corporate worship, coming together as a body, and then as individuals, you go out like spokes from a wheel and do the work after you've come together for that. Now, chapter 12, there are three primary divisions about worship. The first is worship through the renewing of our minds, verses 1 and 2. Secondly, we'll be worshiped by experiencing spiritual gifts, whatever spiritual gifts you have, and using them. And then third, verses 9 to 21, is worship shown by truly loving others. So it starts within. It starts within. Now, how do you explain being a living sacrifice? Paul starts off, present your bodies as a living sacrifice. What do you think of when you think of living sacrifice?
Falling on hand grenades.
Well, you might fall on a hand grenade. Okay, what the Israelites did in Judaism, sacrificing an animal, a sheep or a goat or a dove or a pigeon, all those kinds of things. Although, quite frankly, as we found in our Old Testament studies, there were more grain sacrifices and libation sacrifices than there were animal sacrifices. But, yeah, you know, in Rome, public ritual sacrifices thrived. And those sacrifices might be to the gods with an animal. Those sacrifices might be in the Colosseum. I mean, those gladiators were actually being sacrificed. Whoever lost, got that was it. They were being sacrificed for the sake of the emperor and the gods. And the bloodthirsty crowd sitting around eating the popcorn. Drinking a big orange drink. Andy Griffith, what it was football. Buddy, have another drink. I think I will have another big orange. But Roman generals, when they would celebrate a great military victory, Roman generals would often offer public sacrifices in massive quantities in pagan temples, in open-air theaters, all those kinds of things. Paul, though, is speaking not about killing, but rather from his Hebrew upbringing. And I know we think about the Jews, and we think about the Jews sacrificing sheep and goats and doves and pigeons, and they did a good bit of that, but they didn't just waste it. They turned around and ate it. But from the Hebrew perspective, it wasn't so much about killing as it was about offering life to God. And so we find that the firstborn male is to be dedicated, and that dedication is to involve sacrifice to God. Well, instead of killing the firstborn male, then you sacrifice the animal on his behalf, but you're not only offering this sacrifice to God, you're offering the life of that firstborn male to be used by God. And so that's what Paul's really talking about here, is perhaps maybe killing off our proclivities and our desires of what we want to do, and offering ourselves, our lives, to God, to be used by God, sacrificing what we would like to do in offering our lives to God. And so he says here, I appeal to you, or I exhort you, or I plead with you. The verb parakalein here from kaleo, which means to call, means to call or to comfort or to exhort. He says, I am calling you out. Basically, you know, people use that phrase, I'm going to call you out. Paul says, I'm calling you out. I'm appealing to you, or I'm exhorting, I'm calling you out, calling you forth. Why? How? By the mercies of God, although some translations can be through the mercies of God, which I think it's really both. Because of God's mercy given to you, and through God's mercy that is in you, by the mercies of God, through the mercy that God has given you, to present your bodies, that is, your living body. Not just your spirit, it's not just the flesh, it's all of your body. Presenting yourself as a living being. As a living sacrifice in God's priestly service. Now, how do we do that? Well, where does he say it starts? Verse 2. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. It's from the Greek word metamorphosis, by the way. And when you've got the caterpillar metamorphizing into a butterfly, it starts as an internal thing and then comes out externally, right? From chrysalis to pupa to five of beans and a nice candy. Hannibal Lecter. But from that caterpillar into a chrysalis, and then a metamorphosis that takes place into the butterfly. And so the word here, transformed, actually comes from the base word metamorphosis, an internal change that shows up externally. Be transformed from the inside out. It's not enough to put up the facade. Of course, Jesus said something about that facade to the scribes and Pharisees. You see, you look like whitewashed tombs, all nice and clean on the outside, but inside full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. Matthew 23. Can't remember the other reference, but it's Matthew 23 for this one. So. Highlighting that internal with external results. So worship and lives of worship transform us internally, our hearts, to Christian action externally. But, and it must be daily, not just Sunday, Wednesday, but it involves the renewing of your mind. That is a new form of consciousness. That's what Paul means here. By the renewing of your mind, a new consciousness, a new mind to which believers are to be transformed. Now, what new mindset are we to have? Like Jesus. We are to have the mind of Christ. And Paul will actually say that very clearly in Philippians, in the Christ hymn of Philippians 2, 5 through 11. That we are to have the mind of Christ. So being transformed. And part of that then allows us not just to jump up and run, but to test. To test what? What are we to test? Here in verse 2. When it says you may prove, it means to test and prove. What? What God's will is, right? And? Okay, to please Him, but what His will is, and what is good, and what is acceptable according to God's will and according to that transformed mind like Jesus. And so that's actually a process. And the process is called discernment. It's a process of discernment. Greek philosophy taught that there was a link between the knowledge of the good and the ability to put it to practical use. It wasn't knowledge for knowledge's sake. Knowledge had to have a practical component. And the effect of that was the virtue of prudence. Prudence in Greek thought was moral reasoning. Proper moral reasoning. And so that's what he's encouraging them to do here, to have that sense of proper moral reasoning. Why? Because of that connection with God, because we've transformed from the inside out, using the mind as a part of that. The process starts inside but moves outside, knowing, as Sarah said, knowing the will of God. The will of God doesn't look just at the little fine point. The will of God has an overarching macro component, right? And so we try to see things not just for us, but then how that fits in renewing our minds and doing this as living sacrifices, we try to see how we fit into the larger plan of God. So that's a constant battle, is knowing the will of God. We may think we know the will of God, but then again, that will of God for us might change another time over here because of the situation. It might change over here for the situation and that kind of thing. So we're constantly going through a process in this living sacrifice of discerning what God would have us to do. What is good or pleasing to God and what is acceptable to God. As Luke Timothy Johnson writes, the Christian moral life Paul here begins to sketch places an emphasis on internal transformation before external rules, on the process of discernment rather than the end decision itself. In other words, the process of discernment leads to the proper decision. And so the focus is on changing inside and discerning what the will of God is. I always get nervous when I really do when people say, well, the will of God is, and then they trot something out. Or I know the will of God for you. I get nervous sometimes too when you take those, you ever take those assessment tests to try and figure out what your gift is and what the will, what your vocation should be? It's like the guy one time says, I know I'm supposed to be a preacher, even though it says, well, sometimes that's not that much different, depending on what you're doing. Depending on what you're trying to sell. But, you know, so that's, once we do that discernment, then we can discover our gift and exercise that gift. It's not so much that we have to take this little test. I have people a lot these days saying, well, and I'll ask students to write about different things. And when we get to 1 Corinthians, write about spiritual gifts sometimes. And they'll say, well, according to this assessment I took in my church, my gifts are prophecy, exhorting, and healing. Okay? Well, how do you exercise those? and I generally don't get a whole lot of. I might get something about the prophecy part, or they may something. Well, you know, well, I learn. I'm a good exhorter. That makes me nervous sometimes too. Well, Paul exhorts a lot. Well, and see, the way what's really interesting is those tests don't really understand that prophecy is not as much about prophesying something off in the future as it is about the recognition of what God expects, where people are, and then speaking to them to try and get them to those things to mesh. The Old Testament prophets, even though they might talk about the future, they say, you know, well, here's what God expects of you, but here's where you really are, and the only way you're going to survive this is if you come back here and God will help you through. And they were good students of history and political science. Yeah. Amos knew. Isaiah knew. The Assyrian army was on the march from the north. And hey, the only way you're going to survive this is if you come back to God. If you don't, you're going to be wiped out. You have nothing to stand on. So prophecy has different meanings. We think of prophecy as somebody telling the future all the time. Yeah. Reading your palm. Yeah, that kind of thing. Tarot cards or whatever. But that was the primary focus of the Old Testament. Well, the primary focus of the New Testament prophet was not on telling the future so much as calling people into a proper relationship with God so that their futures would be more certain because they were in proper relationship with God. But those spiritual gifts. Ah, here comes that word. Charismata. And you think of charismatic. And people say, oh no. But that's not, while that flashy kind of stuff sometimes shows up, that's not really what this is about. Charismata, which is the root word of charisma, is what he talks about here when he says your spiritual gift, your spiritual charisma. It's your personality is part of your charisma. It is that gift that is given that is part of your charisma that helps you share the gospel, helps you bring others to God, helps you serve others for God. That charisma. So he says, for by the grace given to me, I bid everyone among you not to think of himself more highly than he ought, but to think with sober judgment, each according to the measure of his faith which God has assigned him. For as in one body we have many members, and all members do not have the same function, so we, though many, are one body in Christ, individually members one of another, having charismata, or charisma, that differ according to the grace given to us, let us use them. And so Paul says here, you know, gifts, doing God's will, testing what is good, and the gifts that are used are every much as communal as they are individual. You ever notice a lot of times within certain types of charismatic movements, and it happened at the church at Corinth, there are one or two gifts that are pointed out as being the end-all, be-all, and if you don't got it, you don't got the Spirit. I've had that told to me. Well, if you don't do this, you don't have the Spirit. But even in Corinthians, Paul says, it's as the Spirit determines, not as you determine. Here, to the Roman church, where you've got all these different philosophies, Paul says, you are graced with a gift, and that gift, that charisma, that thing that makes you who you are, that can be living service to God and to others, that charisma is not so that you can say, hey, look me over, you know, look at me, but rather it's for the good of the community. It's communal. That's why in 1 Corinthians 14 he says, I'd rather speak, and that one particular gift that people were focusing on, he says, I'd rather speak, 10 words intelligibly than 10,000 in an unknown language. Why? Because it's for the edification of the community, the building up of the community. Here he says once again, everyone is given a grace gift by God. We find what that grace gift is, or those grace gifts are. And then we use them for the community. In chapter 11, he told the Gentiles not to think of themselves too highly or boast because the Jews were blind. Now he says, now wait a minute, be careful. Don't think of yourself so highly, more highly than you ought to. Don't think, hey, well, we're the super guys now. We're the super apostles. We're the super religious. We're the self-righteous. And look down your nose at others because of that. But think with sober judgment according to the measure, the measurement of your faith. In other words, moderation, the appropriate measure of your faith. If you've got this amount of faith for your grace gift to work, don't act like you got this amount. Rather, use what you've got appropriately. Same time, no overkill. If a hammer will do, don't bring a jackhammer. Don't try and be more. Because what happens when that happens, all of a sudden, even though the body has many members and all the members do not have the same function, we are many members in Christ. We're different from one another. We have different gifts. But if you start thinking of yourself too highly, what happens? You end up, instead of serving, you end up putting other people down. Or saying, my gift's better than your gift. No. Well, now some people react better to the two before between the eyes, but really the carrot though, it shouldn't be. If we take the carrot out in front of us, the carrot in our Christian lives and using these grace gifts should not be, oh well, I'm gonna get more stars in my crown for heaven. But the carrot should be trying to get to the point where we improve upon those grace gifts we've got to the point that it helps the community even more, which means we always got something to. Some way to try and help the community more and more and more and build up the community even more. And that's what he's talking about here, is that communal effort with these charisma. And he explains, in building the church, we need to remember two very important things. Number one, each member has value, not only in God's kingdom, but in the church. And number two, no person is to be undervalued. Why? Because everyone's valuable to God. And if we're all valuable to God, then we shouldn't undervalue other folks that are in the church with us. Which is a very big contrast to Rome. In Rome, pride, competition, comparison were touted. Paul says here, God graces people with spirit-led abilities to prophesy. Here, to prophesy means to use the gift of your mind and your speech to convince the community of the faith. But once again, it's according to the amount of faith you have. If service, and the word here to serve is actually a form of diakonia, if service, then serve. Don't say, oh, well, I can't, or... But serve, and don't say, well, I'm serving as an elder, or I'm serving as a deacon, so I'm going to tell you, you need to do this, and you need to do that. That's not service. See, if your gift is service, then you need to serve. If your gift is teaching, didaskalion, then study and teach, once again, using the mind. But notice, every one of these, there's not a one of these things that says sit back and relax. Every one of them is an action word. Every one of them is an action word. To encourage, parakalein, that is to exhort or encourage. The word doesn't just mean to exhort. This is what you're doing wrong, you better get right. But the word also means encourage. Barnabas was son of encouragement. Same basic word from parakalein. If yours is to encourage, then encourage. Don't just sit back. But encourage folks. Exhort folks. He goes on to say, he who contributes or gives in liberality. Do what? Wait a minute. Yeah. The word here means to share liberally. To share liberally. He who gives aid, do so with zeal. Now, to give aid here, the word is the root word for he who has authority to lead, lead out with zeal. Giving aid here is to lead out with zeal, to lead. He who does acts of mercy with cheerfulness. The word literally could be translated here too. Show mercy with liberality. Just like sharing or giving liberally, show mercy with liberality. Be cheerful in showing mercy. Don't be begrudgingly showing mercy or showing mercy to see what you're going to get in return, but to give it freely and to give it liberally. Once again, all of these are action words. So what is the glue that holds all this together? What's the glue that holds all this together? From renewing and transforming of the minds to using these grace gifts, what is the glue that holds all that together? Love. First word of the very next verse. Love, be genuine. Love, be genuine. We translate it, let love be genuine. We worship by loving others. And these are in the forms of imperatives. Be genuine in your love. By the way, the word used here is a form of agape. That is, love people genuinely as God loves you. Genuinely. Hate what is evil and hold fast what is good. That's typical Jewish fashion coming out of Paul's Jewish background. The negative first and then the positive. Hate evil. Hold on to what is good. Verse 10. Love one another. Up here we've got a different word. A form of philine. With brotherly affection. If you can't love them totally with agape, at least love them and treat them with brotherly affection. Brotherly love, which philine, phileo is the idea not just of brotherly love, but the love of a parent for a child and a child for a parent. There are other things he says here too. Never flag in zeal. In other words, never stop in zealousness. Don't get tired of being zealous. But be aglow with what? With spiritual fervor, or be aglow with the Spirit. Don't hold it inside in the dark. Let it show out from you. Serve the Lord. All of this is, these are imperatives. Rejoice in your hope and be patient in tribulation, being constant in prayer. The only way to get through the tribulation genuinely is to persevere in prayer. And the word actually used in my translation says be constant, but it's actually the word for perseverance, those who persevere. It's not the preservation of the saints, it's the perseverance of the saints that takes place. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. That almost sounds like something Jesus might say. I think he did in the Sermon on the Mount. So see, here Paul's not so far away from Jesus. How to treat those who are not close friends. These others, okay, these are my close friends. Yeah, I'll love them. I'll show them brotherly affection. I'll serve them. I'll rejoice. I'll pray for them. I'll contribute to the needs of the saints and practice hospitality, verse 13. And then he says, oh, by the way, that's all well and good for those people that are like you or have the good taste to love you first. But it's more than that. And this was especially difficult for Paul's audience because where are they living? In what city? Rome. It's written to the Romans. They're living in Rome. And what's all around them? Romans and Greeks that think differently than this. And guess who's in power around this time? You're talking about Nero. And Paul is saying, bless your enemies and don't curse them. That's tough. Practice, serve as hosts to them. Bless your enemies. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Oh, that's great with our brothers and sisters, right? But look at the context. Who's he moved on to? Yeah, those that aren't like you. Even your enemies. If they're mourning, you need to mourn with them. That's really tough. And especially these days when you think about a lot of things that are going on in the world. We're not to seek retribution. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. That is, the humble. Never be conceited. Uh-oh. Repay no one evil for evil, but take thought for what's noble. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. In other words, Paul's not saying, if it depends on you, he says, you, if it's possible, you do everything you can to make peace possible. It depends on you. They are. They are. Through oral tradition, through praying and all of that, yes.
Jesus said, no big deal loaning money to your friends. You know they'll pay you back, loaning it to your enemies.
Yeah. Yeah. But even if you're wronged unfairly, he says, don't seek retribution. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, and here he quotes from Deuteronomy 32:35. And we love to say this verse. Vengeance. Well, we kind of leave out three words. Vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Yes, and there, I have to admit, there are times when, okay, Lord, you said vengeance is mine. Can I be your instrument? You need volunteers? Here I am. But the Romans, the Greeks, even early Judaism taught that if you had an enemy that wronged you, it was okay to seek vengeance. In fact, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, limb for limb, stripe for stripe, life for life was used as a means of saying, okay, well, hey, it's okay to seek vengeance. Although, literally, it's no more than eye for eye, tooth for tooth. It was a limit to vengeance, but it was still okay to go get that vengeance. And Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, and Paul says, here in Romans chapter 12, no, vengeance is God's, not yours. And then he goes even further. No, if your enemy's hungry, don't stand inside and wave the meat in the window and say, ah, look what I got. Feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink. Of course, that almost sounds like the parable of the Last Judgment in Matthew 25, too. I was hungry and you gave me food. Thirsty, you gave... Well, when did we do that? When you gave it to the least of these. And yes, we think about the poor, but also if your enemy is in trouble, is he not among the least? So these things are hard. These are things we like to kind of scuff over a lot. For by doing so, you will heap burning coals upon his head. And you think, oh, hey, well, I won't punish him doing that. No. The whole idea of the burning coals here is seen as perhaps as he thinks back to what he has done to you and yet you're treating him this way with kindness and providing for him, that perhaps he might find somewhere along the line a change of heart, a change of mind. And do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with a bigger gun, right? No. Overcome evil with good.
Well, you didn't hear our Salvation Army speak
right?
What's the word he used? He said they gave non-toxically or something like, meaning that, you know, there's not conditions or provisions, but we're going to
right.
give you this, but you've got to do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and
right.
and everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah,
toxic giving. Well, that wouldn't be anything like, well, yeah, you can come through our trunk or treat and get your candy, but first you got to sit in this little room and listen to an evangelistic sermon. That actually happened several years ago here in Piedmont at another church.
Whoa.
At trunk or treat, they were holding trunk or treat, and some of them do. If you're going to stay here tonight. Can't have any drugs, can't have any alcohol, and by the way, we'll give you supper, but then you gotta go in this room and sit and listen to this song, you sing these songs and listen to this preacher. Yeah, there are some that do that, Jerry. In fact, I know of one in Anderson County that does that. We still gave them blankets to give out to homeless people, but that was, and the students who helped do that particular year, when they went walking in with the blankets, the guy was explaining, yeah, these folks, yeah, you can give them these blankets, and we have here, and here's where we feed them, and you'll see this piano and these hymnals and these chairs set up and this cross. In order to eat and spend the night, they have to attend our worship service. But yeah, toxic giving with strings attached, and, you know, we'd like to have some strings attached, right? Sometimes. Because you think, am I really going to give this person money? I'll tell you what, I'll just go buy them some food. Hand them some food and hope they eat it. Most of the time they do. Yeah. Well, that's true. That's true, Jim.
I like what you said, though. Instead of giving $5 bills, they can buy them $5 packs right there and food itself.
Well,
when I
see the sign, and I don't do it as often as I should, but every now and then I'll do it, and it says either we'll work for, or hungry, God bless you. If I feel so led, I'll go to the closest fast food, get a meal, come back. And I've had a couple of times where the food was refused, but most of the time they're happy to get it. Yeah. Nah. I had a guy one time when I swung through a Hardee's that was standing on the street corner one morning, and I got two sausage biscuits, hash browns, and a large coffee. And I even told him, I said, throw in creamer and stuff in the bag, because I don't know if they drink coffee or coffee flavored beverages. And I swung back around the corner, the guy was still standing there with a sign that says, hungry, please help, God bless you. I said, I rolled my window down. I said, here, I want to give you some breakfast. He said, I don't want food, I want the money. And he was probably in his mid to late 20s. I don't want food, I want the money. I said,
he
wanted the breakfast of champions, I'm sure. But you know, he said, no, I don't want that, I want the money. Just, if you don't give me the money, go on. So I drove through downtown Greenville and saw a guy fumbling through the trash can like this, and he snatched it up like that. But you know, these things, think about what of these things, I know we've run over, stand out to you. And really, and it might lead you to think, and sometimes I do, you know, it sure is tough on God to think we need to do all these things. Or rather, it's tough of God for us. Sometimes it's tough on God because we don't do it. But this whole idea of our bodies, it's an internal change that then results in doing things externally, and not just so we can get brownie points or another star in a crown. All these people talking, they're going to get stars in a crown. I'm thinking, well, if you read this stuff, it says you're going to cast your crown down, so you're not even going to get to keep it. But all of this, you know, we sit around, we think about these things, we talk about them, and And yeah, that's really good. But then the real question is, what do I do with it 24 hours, 36 hours later and beyond? But those are the duties Paul gives as Christian behavior. If we are truly of Christ, then therefore, if you have truly been saved, these are the things that you will do. It's not, hey, I'll do these things and get saved. But it's if you've truly been redeemed, then these are the things you will do. 7:02. Yeah, y'all going to be singing next week. You will get comp time. Thank y'all. Yes? God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.